Bonjour. Buenos dias. Good morning. Good to see you all, my brothers and sisters in Christ. Welcome here. We are continuing our preaching series on Exodus, our saving and forming indwelling God. And where we are in this series is on this forming part. And I just want to kind of give you a little bit of a heads up. In the planning of this preaching series, we were going to cover today everything from the water turned sweet in Exodus 15 all the way to the blessing of Jethro's wisdom in Wisdom 18. And that was because there's this connection all the way, this flow through the water to the glory of the quail, the manna, the resolution of the hostility with the people, and then with the Amalekites, and then finally to Jethro's blessing and wisdom. And I thought we could get through this all in one Sunday. I was wrong. I am planning, I bit off more than I could chew. So heads up, we're not addressing the Amalekites and Jethro's wisdom today. Hopefully we'll have more on that at a later time. Where we do find ourselves is at this really interesting moment in the story of Exodus. What you had heard read today by our brother Wes follows on the heels of this burst of praise that and worship as in the earlier parts of Exodus 15. Because when the people came through the sea on dry land, the Israelites saw the mighty hand of the Lord displayed. This is quoting from Exodus 14:31, against the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord and put their trust in him and in Moses, his servant. And where we find ourselves is in a wilderness, in a desert, a land that is lacking in just about everything you need for the basics of life. Food is scarce, water is scarcer, the heat beats down all day, it's freezing at night. But the wilderness is where God has led them. This has been the plan all along, that they would be let go from Egypt and would go into the wilderness with God on their way to the promised land. The wilderness, while harsh and unforgiving, desolate place, is also a place of purpose in Scripture. It's here that the Israelites will learn what it means to fear God and put their trust in him. They have sung it. Now it's opportunity to live it. The wilderness is a place of dependence because there is such need there. In the wilderness, the Israelites will be taught and formed to put their trust in the Lord. And in his provision for the Israelites, we see that God's provision is material, things like food and water, and also necessities like the basics of life, threats from other people, but it's also more. And the provision in the desert, we see God's presence, his character revealed to his people. We see the work as God is doing because he's gotten them out of Egypt, a place of tyranny and oppression and slavery, and now he needs to get Egypt out of them. We see how God does so for his people who grumble and complain and are fearful and hostile. He does so with great patience and abundance. He does so with an invitation to know the Lord's provision, but more so, to know the Lord. And so we're going to look at three of these encounters in the desert where the Lord provides today. Three encounters where their desperate needs of the Israelites meets God's abundant provision. And in each, we will have a bit of a framework. We're first going to name the problem. Then we're going to see what the people and Moses do as a result of this problem or issue. And then thirdly, how God responds. And then finally, the results. What happens as a result of the problem and the people's response and God's response? What is God doing to form and shape them? As we look at these accounts of the Lord's provision in the wilderness and the desert, my prayer is that we would also see God's intention for you and for me, for God's intention to lead us from places of oppression into places of learning, to lean on God's provision in the wilderness, in the deep places of need in our lives. So, encounter number one, healing of a desperate lack and disappointing bitterness. In Exodus 15, 22 to 27, we have a problem. And the problem is there is no water. This is a life or death situation. It's been 3 days. And then the people spot water. Can you imagine what it would be like? 3 days without water. And in the distance, water. I mean, maybe the ones who are a bit cynical are saying, finally. The ones who are faithful might be like, oh, I knew the Lord would provide in the nick of time. And then they get to this place that is called Marah, for the water is bitter, and they cannot drink it. And then flows disappointment to join their desperate need. They're nearly dying, and what they thought was relief is useless. Bitterness and disappointment, Mara. So what do the people do? Well, they grumble. Here we hear the first occurrence of this word that will reoccur in the following chapters of Exodus. A word, again, used again and again, not just here, but at times of murmuring and complaint, especially when God's people are in the wilderness. One commentator, H. Junia Pokrivka, puts it this way: grumbling refers to Israel's doubt and rejection of Yahweh's existence and power and promises, which result in the resentful and hostile speech and rebellious acts against Yahweh and Moses. We know that they have just seen miracles and signs and wonders, the mighty hand of the Lord leading them, protecting them, but they have reached a point where death is a real, where is their reality. A real concern because of lack of water. And I think maybe at this point, I would be grumbling too. So what does Moses do? He hears the grumbling and the murmuring and the complaints, and he cries out to the Lord. And the Lord shows him a piece of wood, and he throws it into the water. And he does so, and the water becomes sweet, fit to drink. So how does God respond? God responds through a miraculous sign to provide what his people need to survive. There's more here. This word for show, when the Lord shows Moses this wood, is teaching language. And then the Lord gives a commandment, something binding to the people. God is engaging with teaching his people his ways in this moment. Their desperate need becomes opportunity to learn what God is like. He tells them in verse 26, if you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in your eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all of his decrees, I will not bring you on any of you the diseases I brought in Egypt, for I am the Lord who heals you. God takes this opportunity to reveal that he is a Lord who heals you. And in doing so, God is joining together this basic provision for life, water, with an invitation to find a refreshment for their souls in the Lord who heals. And if they do, it will go well for them because God has said, I am the Lord who heals you. God's response is to heal. Like with bitter water into sweet, is God's provision to heal all the bitterness of his people. He will provide what they need so that their hearts and spirits and attitudes can join their bodies in leaving Egypt. And we see this reinforced with this closing line of this encounter. They come to Elim, which has springs, 12 of them, and palm trees. Date palm trees, 70. So what happens? What's the result of this? The Lord teaches and invites us to know him as the healing one. Healing in Scripture is another way of talking of salvation. They go hand in hand. And so to heal the water, to transform it, to heal their souls from being bitter and transform them, and then he brings them to this place, Elim, with springs and palm trees, symbols of refreshment, symbols of healing, symbols of provision, of rest. And there are 12 springs, as I said, and 70 palm trees, one spring for each tribe, one palm tree for each clan. God has enough to provide the healing for his people, enough for each one. God is bringing his people to a promised land where they will dwell together. But on the way, God is at work with great patience to heal his people. The journey from Egypt to the promised land is how we sometimes talk of our own journey of faith with Jesus. With saying yes to Jesus, he rescues us from the spiritual tyrants of sin and death and evil. He deals with the presence of our lives, defeating their power, symbolized in the waters of our baptism. And then comes the need to sort out the influence of those defeated powers. We are all wounded people. We have been struck and bruised and formed and disciplined in the ways of sin and death and evil. And what God does is come to us in our grumbling, in our complaints, and our worries, and says, I am here, the one who heals you. one who has enough, who is enough to begin the work of sorting us out, undoing the worries, our reactions, our fears, revealing that in him, he can provide the transformation necessary to turn the bitterness of our lives into something good and sweet. And all this is done, this experience of rest and healing, this provision is provided in the wilderness where we face such lack and need God so much. God provides. And when we're not sure where you're going or what the purpose is, we are with God on the way. And there he gives us this foretaste of where we're going. Springs and dates, refreshment, healing, provision. So I might ask myself, do I think I can complain before God? No, I don't want to encourage you to go all full out making this your life. I don't want you to become bitter. But God brings them to a place of bitterness so that the water there can be healed and that they can be healed. And I might want to say that if that is in you, if there are deep wounds, if there are long-lasting shadows of Egypt or sin or evil, if there is complaints and murmuring in you where you find it hard to trust that the Lord heals, I want you to see that God is so patient with his people. Would you let him provide and show himself to you as the one who can heal you? I ask myself, am I willing to be so humble and vulnerable to learn the patient and present provision of God to teach me his ways in life and the trust that he has me where he needs me in the desert? Okay. Exodus 16, encounter 2, glory, quail, and what is it, bread? Here's the problem in Exodus 16. At least at our first reading, it would seem that the problem is lack of food. We again hear these people grumbling from Exodus 16:3, if only we had died by the Lord's hand in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat and ate all the food we wanted. But you, here pointing the finger at Moses and Aaron, you have brought us out in the desert to starve this entire assembly to death. They think they're starving. Now, if that's true, then this would be another story like the first one of desperate need. However, as we pause and think on what they're saying and their situation, a different problem emerges. First, did the Israelites have pots of meat and ate all that they wanted in Egypt? Anyone take a guess? No! They were slaves! They barely survived! They had just barely enough, a meager existence. Further, here's my next question for you all. When Israel left Egypt, what did they leave with? Sorry, I heard someone. Oh, I can't hear somebody. I hear someone talking, but I can't hear the words. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm getting too old for this. Yes, they get all these gifts. There, some of the people come with them. And in Exodus 12, where did I see this here? In Exodus 12, 38, it says this. They took with them large droves of livestock, both flocks and herds. They have plenty of food. Now, maybe their grain, their cereal has run out. But to claim they're in a dire situation is false. The problem as the Israelites face uncertainty and hardship is their default is not to obedience, but to fear and to worry. And when that happens, no amount of abundant flocks and herds and provision can undo the lies they hold before their eyes. So the people grumble and complain. And here the Lord responds before Moses can. And I want to pause and make sure we hear this correctly, because if you're following through and reading this way, you can think like, oh, if I complain, the Lord will give me what I need. That's not the story to take away, okay? The lesson isn't complain and get your way. The lesson is, despite your grumbling and fear getting in the way of trust, of trusting the Lord is gracious to his people. That's the lesson to take away here. It's despite the complaining, God provides. And part of the problem that these people have in this moment with food is that it's an allegation against Moses. They say, we've been brought here to starve. They can only see what is lacking. And God responds first by showing them the purpose that they have been brought there. They say, we've been brought here to starve. And God says, no, actually, you've been brought here to know my glory. We miss that sometimes when we remember this passage about miraculous manna and quail, that the first thing that people need is not to see the quail or the manna, not to have the food provided, is to have their eyes refocused on God's glory. There is this cloud that goes with them, the cloud, pillar of smoke by day and fire by night. And if we slide a bunny trail, even aside here, there's provision in this, smoke by day, to shield from the heat of the sun, fire by night to warm them. And the whole assembly, and as they're grumbling and not seeing what God has already provided for them, they're told to come out and look to the cloud. And there God reveals his glory. The Israelites complained that Moses brought them to the desert to starve. That's not why they're in their wilderness. They're in the wilderness because they will witness and know the glory of God. He goes on to tell them that his glory will be further shown and proven in the quail that comes in the evening and the daily bread, but it begins in a revelation, an unveiling of God's presence in their midst in the cloud. Verse 11 and 12 of Exodus 16 reads, the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the grumbling of the Israelites. Tell them, at twilight you will eat meat, and in the morning you will be filled with bread, and then you will know that I am the Lord your God. God goes on to respond with instructions about this daily bread. It gets called manna because when the people see it, they say, what is it? And manna sounds kind of like Hebrew, what is it? And so God instructs his people. He says, listen, every day you're to take as much as you want for the day, as much as you need for the day, but it's just for the day. Don't save any for the next day, except on the sixth day. The sixth day, take an extra portion for the seventh day, because on the seventh day, it's a day of rest, there's no work, and there will be no manna provided that day. So just fill your boots doubly so on the sixth day to provide on the seventh day. And we also find out this manna is delicious. It tastes like coriander and honey. Who likes those things? I kind of do. Two flavors that still delight people's palates today. This is what God does for them. And what is the result? Well, after twice giving instructions, very clear instructions, the people immediately mess it up. There's enough to satisfy them, but some are worried. And so when they go to collect the manna and they take as much as they think they need for that day, they ration it out a bit too meagerly. They think, oh, maybe God won't actually give us enough for tomorrow. So this great amount we have for today, we won't eat it all. We'll save some for tomorrow. And what do? They go hungrier than they need, and they rise in the morning to find that what was scrimped and hoarded has rot, and it's full of maggots. And what do they see all around them? New manna for a new day. The Lord instructed that on the sixth day they should gather twice as much, because that extra will not gather on the seventh day, but provide for their day of rest. And what happens? Some folks go out looking for manna and find there is no manna on the seventh day. In verses 28 to 30, we begin to hear a little bit of God's displeasure of his people and their disobedience and their lack of faith. But I also want us to notice that he re-instructs. Three times instructions are given on how to collect manna in Exodus 16. The last time is especially about for the Sabbath day. And I want you to notice God's willingness to teach and teach again and reteach his people. We are not so different from these people who are messed up from living years as slaves in Egypt. They need to hear the ways of the Lord again and again and again, and so do we. And God gives these instructions not just because he's God and he can do this. He does it for their good. This third time he instructs with the manna, it's about God's concern that they have a day of rest. Years as slaves, years told all that they are good for,
is what they can do to help build up the power and the name of their oppressor, where they're told that they have no worth beyond that. And God is saying, no, you have rest. I have rest for you. This is my ways. I want you to learn it. Like the God's commands here are not onerous. It's a way to enjoy the abundant provision of God. This is a gift of God, to know that we don't have to survive on our efforts alone. That God is a God who is patient to teach and show us that his words are for us, for our life, for our good. We know we need daily bread, but we need to remember that God has us, that we can learn to trust and obey again and again. And so God patiently reaches out and teaches his people. I've seen this in my life. There are some things it takes a long time to get God's words through my thick skull and into my hard heart. Again and again, I've seen God reach out and say, Chris, let me teach you my ways for my glory and for your good. I hope you have seen that too, that when we are not faithful, God remains faithful. And because God is for our good, even in our disobedience, he continues to teach us his ways, to lead us in paths of righteousness. I want us to notice one other thing. Sometimes we get this idea that blessing, salvation, provision, and presence, all that of God comes after we have proven ourselves to him. That our faithfulness somehow unlocks God's blessing. We put in the work, and then the blessing will come. But I want you to look what happens in the wilderness. Manna comes even when some are disobedient. Those who hoard it and find it rotten the next day still have manna for that day. The provision comes and it's enough for all. The blessings of God are there to point us, even in our disobedience, back to the Lord who is faithful when we are not. That he is for our good, even when we fail to follow his good ways. It's not that we behave well and somehow earn God's favor. Our God has favor for us. And in learning of his goodness, we learn to be faithful as he is. And so even in our disobedience, he pours out his mercy and grace. Verse 35 of Exodus 16 reads, "The Israelites ate manna for 40 years. Until they came to a land that was settled, they ate manna until they reached the border of Canaan. Through the grumbling and complaints, the rebelling, the idolatry, all the things that go on in the rest, until they reach those borders, there is an abundance of the Israelites' sins, great and small, each day for 40 years. And each day, despite their disobedience, despite all of that, God feeds his people. He gives them what they need to get them to where they need to be, where he will dwell with them. Each day his faithfulness is shown. Daily his people encounter the awe of God that he is good and faithful for our good, even when we are not." What do you think happens to a people who are blessed and are given what is needed, even when they know they are so undeserving? What does that do to our wounds of fears and mistrust to see a faithful provider? What depths of sin is being healed here? What heights of love is being shown? And if you're new to this whole faith thing or young, I want you to go and find someone who's older to you than you and ask them this week, what have you learned and what has changed in you that God has been faithful each and every day of your life? And if you're older, find someone younger and just tell them. It's okay. They need to listen to their elders. I need to listen to my elders. I'm becoming an elder. That's good too. But ask and share what God has done to form and disciple you in by giving you every day what you need in the walk in wilderness of life and faith. Encounter 3, Exodus 17, 1-7. Complaints become quarreling, stones threatened, and stones struck. In Exodus 17, the problem, well, as it opens up, is once again water, supposedly. They're being led by the Lord, and where they're led to camp, there is nothing to drink. What began as grumbling, maybe even understandably so in Exodus 15, grew in Exodus 16 to begin accusing Moses and Aaron. And here in Exodus 17, the grumbling takes on a new level. It becomes quarreling. These are different words. Before, if the idea is complaint or murmuring, here the idea is hostility, adversaries. It's a word used in bringing a lawsuit against another. I have a charge against you. And what began as just maybe, again, understandably grumbling, then focused on Moses and Aaron, now is focused on what the Lord has done. The problem is best seen in what Moses calls this place, Massah and Meribah, because the Israelites quarreled and because they tested the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Meribah from quarreling and Massah from the Hebrew for testing. You see, this question, is the Lord among us or not, is the heart of the problem. The murmuring against Moses has turned into calling into question not just the good intents and purposes of God's servant Moses, but the Lord himself. And this is a serious problem throughout the Psalms and in the New Testament as well. If you want to be warned against disbelief and quarreling, against testing the Lord, then Massah and Meribah are brought up. Do not let your hearts harden as on that day, Massah and Meribah. This is a serious, serious problem. A serious warning as well of the awful consequences of what happens when we refuse to trust, when we remain stubborn, when our hearts remain hard, when we refuse to heed God's words and messengers and ways. So what do the people do? Well, the words start off quite hostile, and then it turns into a threat of violence. They're ready to stone Moses. They're ready to kill him. The deadly situation where it was water at the beginning, this external threat to them, is now an internal one in the people of God. They're turning on their leader. They're turning on their Lord. Further, this question, is the Lord with us or not, is counter to everything God has been saying to his people, what he is doing for them in Exodus. Our God saves us and forms us so he can come to dwell with us as our God. And God has shown himself again and again to his people that he is with them and for them. That even though the wilderness is a testing place where God intends to form his people that they can trust God and have God be their Lord of their life and they be their people, they're there so that they can learn to be enthroned God by learning that he is the one who heals and provides, is present. Instead, they turn it into a testing of God, accusing God of being absent, accusing God of not being for their good, of being against them. And this deep question of whether God is for us, with us, I think it's in us too. It is a question Egypt pressed deeply into the souls of the Israelites. It's a question we who live in a sinful and fallen world get pressed deeply into us. Is God for us? Is God with us? So what does God do? Well, having come out of Egypt, there is still much of Egypt in the Israelites. We will learn more about this again and again over the next coming weeks. They need healing and teaching and restoration. They need reconciliation. They need something that will provide them the opportunity to take another step of faith and to let God heal this part of their souls. And God, so what does God do? He gives them a sign. It's like a mirror image of the sign he first gave to Pharaoh in Egypt. The first sign in Egypt was Moses going before Pharaoh and his entourage and striking the waters of the Nile with his staff. And when he does, the Lord turns the life-giving waters of the Nile, the very backbone of its economy, its transportation, the source of its nourishment and provision of the Egyptians, into blood, a sign of death. Here, at Massah and Meribah, quarreling and testing, the Lord once again stands with Moses, this time, though, before the unbelieving, fearful, worrying, stubborn, quarreling, hostile Israeli people who are questioning if God is with them. They have death in their hearts and in their eyes. They're holding stones in their hands. And the Lord tells Moses to go before them and to take the elders and to know that the Lord will be before Moses. And there, Moses is to take the staff that struck the Nile and now strike a rock. If you don't know how the story ends, I wonder if we're expecting the same kind of outcome as God had for Pharaoh. A sign that really puts them in their place. A sign that really beats them down. A sign that really shows them that God is against them. That's after all what they're asking. But what comes out of the rock when it is struck? This time, the strike of the staff turns a deadly situation into a life-giving one. From a complete lack of water came everything that was needed, a flow of water to provide for all the people, because the Lord is for his people. The Lord is for you. Even in their quarreling, even in their hostility, even in their stubbornness, even in their lack of faith, God provides. God provides. And as he does, he begins to heal them. With his presence, he comforts. With his words, he leads. These questions pressed deeply into their lives by Egypt are answered, that he is a God who heals, who steps into the worst of circumstances and makes a way. He gives his glory, his presence to undo their quarreling, to set aside hostility, to be fed and nurtured, to satisfy every longing of their bodies and of their spirits. God is making a way in the most hostile of places to the most hostile of people to show that he is not like Pharaoh. He is a different kind of king who, again, with a great patience and grace, comes a way to make for our good and to show his glory. Like in Egypt, though, this is an opportunity that invites us either to take a step to go with the one who heals, to turn from hostility, let our hearts be softened by the glory and wonder in the presence of the Lord, or to remain stubborn and hard-hearted and stay in Egypt with Pharaoh, stubborn in our ways. But it is a question that the Lord asks. Will you believe? Will you trust? Will you have faith? Do you know that I am with you? Do you know that I am for you? As we move towards communion, I again want to apologize for not getting to the Amalekites and to Jethro's wisdom and blessing in Exodus 17, 18. I'm going to see if I can work them into our sermon series sometime. But if you really want to talk about those, here's another option. Come make an appointment with me. Let's read through those chapters and pray and discuss them together. I think that would be delightful. And maybe, just maybe, I won't be the one who ends up preaching it, and that would be cool too. We can preach it together. Okay, back to this. The Israelites have so much to unlearn. The wilderness and problems they face each time God took as an opportunity to reveal who he is and shape his people, to disciple his people, to have him, the Lord, as their king in their hearts and in their heads and in their songs, as he shows them that he is one who has all that they need. He provided healing and rest. He provides daily provision and his glorious presence. He makes peace and is patient to teach and instruct his people in his good ways and ways of righteous living and faithful obedience. And we're not so different. Having much to unlearn, having much that we long for, thirsty and hungry for material and for spiritual bread, for something that can satisfy our souls, finding our place in a hostile world where death and sickness and sin seem to be all around, where there are threats to us, and desert places. Jesus tells us in John 6, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. And so we come in with Jesus on the way to where he is taking us, to our promised rest. And we may find ourselves still wounded and bitter and weary. And so the Lord tells us he will carry our burdens, that he has come as a physician to heal the sick and to call sinners to repentance. We sometimes doubt if God is for us as well. And to that we hear Jesus given the name Emmanuel, God with us. We see threats and lack and meager existence in this fallen world, and we wonder what God will do to set it right, where he will be to heal and to save. And we read in John 1:14, the word that is Jesus became flesh and made his dwelling among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father full of grace and truth. So church, in the wilderness of life, on this path of faith, where God has healed us and is healing us and is taking us to new creation life, we have God in person, Jesus. We have him revealing the glory of God, showing us what is needed, showing us that God is not far or distant from you, and not against you. Instead, God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him will not perish but have everlasting life. The Israelites had signs and wonders in the Passover and in the wilderness. We have the sign of the greater Passover, the cross, and the greater provision of new life and Jesus' resurrection. There is for you incredible, abundant provision of being God's people. That he tells us he will be our daily bread, our nourishment until we reach where we are going, the fullness of new creation life in Jesus. And until then, even then, there is rest to enjoy and delight to be encouraged by, because we have this incredible healing, rest, and salvation in Jesus.